And how did you reach that conclusion? I am careful to present facts, not feelings. All of the injuries to Captain Burgess's neck were consistent with hanging, a clean break and substantial rope burns. But the injuries to the rest of his body were those of a man who has been beaten, numerous cuts and bruises and broken bones.
And have you ever seen a hanging before? He asks,
and I dislike the tone of condescension I hear. Yes. A single word, no explanation, but I hope the certainty in that one syllable makes it clear that I do know of what I speak.
I see. And did you find a rope on his person?
I did not.
And did you not think it odd?
No. It only reinforced my belief that he had been murdered. If Burgess had hung himself, he would have been found dangling from a tree, rope intact, and not lodged in the river. Hubbard scratches notes in his ledger.
Thank you, Mistress Ballard.
He looks up.
Dr. Page.
Yes.
Please explain your original assessment. In my studies at Harvard Medical School, I performed dissections on more than one man found dead in the harbor. Water can do tremendous damage to the human body. And given that there was no rope present on the deceased, it seemed likely that the injuries could have been made in a post-mortem state.
And were you able to determine how long the body had been dead before entering the river?
I postulated death by drowning, sir.
Was there water in his lungs?
I did not perform a dissection on this man, so it is possible
that he was deceased when he entered the river.
I did not think so at the time. Hubbard looks at me.
Mistress Ballard?
Yes.
How long do you think he was dead before entering the water?
I doubt more than a few moments, I say.
Why?
The bruises. He had dozens of them, and they were fresh. Most were pink and swollen. Some were bright purple. But none the green and brown of a fading bruise, I tell the court. Then, add carefully, in my 3 decades of tending patients, I have never seen a dead man bruise. Blood pools after death, Your Honor. It doesn't rush to the skin's surface. He looks at Paige, lifts an eyebrow.
Is that correct, Doctor?
It is, but have you ever seen a hanging, Dr. Page?
I have performed more than one dissection on such.
I did not ask you if you had ever seen a hanged man, but a man hanged. Have you?
No.
Thank you. You may both be seated.
If I may, Your Honor. Page takes a step forward.
Yes.
You asked me to explain my original assessment, but I would like the court to know that it has since changed.
Pray tell why that might be,
Hubbard asks. Pertinent information was kept from me during my initial examination.
Do explain.
It has come to my attention that the victim was in a violent confrontation just hours before his body was found. Had I known that, it would have factored into my assessment. I am sometimes astonished at how still I can be while my heart is racing. How dare, Paige? James Parker takes over the questioning now.
Do you know whom Burgess fought that night?
Paige lifts his chin, dares one sideways look at me.
Indeed, I do. He fought with Mistress Ballard's oldest son, Cyrus.
It is as though someone has taken a boot to a beehive, the way the room begins to buzz. These judges are not so quick to lose control of a courtroom as North was, however, and Wood brings it back to attention immediately with 3 hard whacks of his gavel. Taking his cue, Dr. Page returns to his seat. I watch him wind through the room and deposit himself at a long table beside a pretty young woman. She's the kind of girl who will always look childlike no matter how old she grows. Small, narrow, fine-boned. All of this, even though she is, as Samuel Coleman told me not long ago, quite far along in a pregnancy. She rests her hand on her swollen belly and looks at her husband as though he has descended from Mount Olympus just for this occasion.
Mistress Ballard,
I lift my chin, turn back to the judges.
Did you know of this confrontation earlier?
Not when I inspected the body, Your Honor. I found out later that same day.
From whom?
I clear my throat. Members of my household.
And was this information delivered in the form of a confession?
He asks. No, absolutely not. My daughters attended a frolic the evening before with their brothers. Burgess was also there. And when he tried to force my eldest girl to dance, Cyrus stopped him. There are at least 10 people in this room who saw the altercation and can attest to those facts. They all saw Burgess leave the dance in good health, and that Cyrus did not follow. But I do not think it has any bearing on this investigation.
Is that your professional opinion or your personal one?
He asks. Both.
And after the dance, where did your son go?
He escorted his sisters home, then went to bed.
Can anyone account for where he was in the middle of the night?
What a poisonous bunch-backed toad, I think. He was in bed when I was called to a birth, at 2 o'clock that morning, I say, and it takes a great effort to keep the venom from my voice. Obadiah Wood looks at his copy of Henry Sewell's court record. He asks,
when you first gave your testimony on cause of death, did you include that information?
I did not.
Why? Your son beat the man.
There's no law against it, I say. Not when he was protecting his sister from unwanted advances against a man who had already been accused of rape. And besides, Burgess walked away from that altercation, as witnessed by many people. Whereas the man I inspected in this tavern would not have been able to walk at all. Whatever happened to him occurred after he left the frolic.
Is your son in the courtroom today?
I feel Cyrus's presence before I see him. He's come to stand behind me now. He is.
State your full name for the court, please,
Obadiah Wood says. There was a long, painful stretch of time in which Cyrus says nothing. He has no speech, Your Honor, I explain.
The judges look at one another, mystified. He cannot speak at all?
Cyrus is mute. I cannot bear the wave of embarrassment that washes over his face, the way he clenches his teeth, then straightens his jaw.
Is he deaf as well? Can he understand our questions?
Acid laces each syllable of my reply. He is not deaf. He can understand all your questions, and he can reply with the language of his body or in writing. Cyrus is fully literate. Of all the men on the bench, Judge Parker seems most fascinated by this turn of events. He leans forward, resting his elbows on the table.
Did you get into a physical altercation with Joshua Burgess the night before he died?
He asks. Cyrus nods.
Did you kill the man?
He shakes his head, plainly denying the accusation.
Is it true that you can read and write?
He nods.
We will require a written deposition in your own hand, preferably by the end of the day, stating your version of events as they relate to the altercation with Joshua Burgess. Are you willing to provide that?
Again the nod. The judges huddle together at their table, heads bent, voices low, and fingers tapping their notes. After several moments, Hubbard straightens and says,
Mistress Ballard.
I take a step closer to the table. You are hereby recused as witness in any capacity with regards to the investigation of the murder of Joshua Burgess. Please take your seat. Once I have situated myself on the bench beside Ephraim, Hubbard continues.
However, the court has determined that further investigation is needed. No official cause of death will be declared at this time, but we will address the accusation that has been made against Mr. Isaac Foster, husband of the defendant.
He looks at his docket.
A Sally Pierce has previously stated before this court that she heard Mrs. Foster confess that her husband murdered Joshua Burgess. We will hear from her first.
I hadn't realized that Sally was present. She comes forward as asked, her father at her side, looking everywhere but at me. Sally still wears her riding cloak and has it pulled tight across her chest. It's as though she's consoling herself with its weight and warmth.
Miss Pierce?
Yes. Even though Sally looks at Hubbard, her eyes are unfocused.
Please tell us what you heard Mrs. Foster say.
Sally clears her throat, but her voice shakes regardless. She was in the middle of a conversation with Mistress Ballard, who had come to tell her that Joshua Burgess was dead. And I'd heard her say, Isaac did kill him. Plain as day, she said it. And I never meant to get anyone in trouble, but I must tell the truth. That is what my father says. She looks at her feet then, and I can barely hear her next words. He says I have to.
Mistress Ballard?
I stand again.
Were you there that day? And is that what you heard?
I was there, and I did give Rebecca the news. I thought it should come from a friend. But because Sally was listening at the door to a conversation that was none of her concern, she only heard half of what Rebecca told me.
And what was the other half?
She said, I hope that Isaac did kill him. And can you blame her? I look to Ephraim, offer the ghost of a smile. I would hope no less of my own husband in that situation.
Ms. Pierce?
Her hands begin to shake. Sir?
Is it possible that you heard only part of what Mrs. Foster said?
William Pierce sets his hand on Sally's shoulders, and, like he did the first time they came to court, I see his thumb and forefinger pinch the muscle between neck and shoulder. I have told the court exactly what I heard. A wince. Sir? Sally can feel the weight of my gaze, and her eyes shift to the side when I speak again. Though I am certain Miss Pierce is a paragon of virtue, and that she would never purposefully deceive anyone, I remained firm in my certainty that she misheard the conversation. I reach over and grab Rebecca's trembling hand, give it a reassuring squeeze. The judges confer quietly for a moment. Then Hubbard says,
We will move on to the next matter.
Isaac Foster jumps to his feet, takes a big step toward the table where the judges are sitting.
Are you not going to ask my wife what she said? Or let me speak in my own defense?
Obadiah Wood clears his throat.
The record already states that you denied the accusation. We did not feel it needed to be clarified, as you were so adamant in Vesselboro.
Isaac's rage slackens, but only slightly.
Then I expect you will also give my wife the same chance to defend herself. Very well, Mrs. Foster, Wood said. Please clarify for the court exactly what you said to Mistress Ballard that day.
Rebecca stands. It is exactly as Martha said. I told her that I hoped my husband killed Joshua Burgess, that I wasn't sad to hear he'd died. And I do not regret a word of it. And then she gives Sally a withering look. Because it is true.
Judge James Parker leans forward, his great hawk nose jutting out.
Thank you, Mrs. Foster.
Your testimony will be recorded by the clerk, and we will now move on to the other matter at hand. Will you please tell the court what occurred on the evening of August 10th?
I can tell that Rebecca is frightened in a way that she had not been in Vassalboro. Her body seems to curl in on itself, making her look smaller than she really is. She steps into the open area before the table.
My husband was in Boston, and I was at home, alone, with our two sons. It was close to midnight, but I was awake, reading, when someone began pounding on the door.
And did you open it willingly? Parker asks.
No, I did not.
Had you bothered to turn the lock before retiring for the evening?
Yes, she says, and I hear a note of acid in her voice, though most people in this village don't bother doing so. The hook is known to be safe, or so I am told. But I was not raised in these parts, and I have long been in the habit of locking my doors at night, even when my husband is home. I happened to be standing in front of it when they kicked it in.
Did you sustain any injuries?
A bruised cheek and a split lip. The door hit me here.
She lays a palm against her cheek, where the ghastly bruises had marred her skin. It is a wonder the impact didn't shatter half the bones in her face.
That's how I ended up on the floor.
Obadiah Wood asks, are you saying that it was Joseph North who entered your house that evening?
Yes, and also Joshua Burgess. I have not forgotten him simply because he is dead.
He nods. Continue, please.
The entire tavern listens, breathless, as she goes on with her account. The two of them had disagreed at that point about the noise and whether she was, in fact, to be harmed. In the end, Burgess helped her to her feet, since she couldn't manage that herself. Black spots floated in front of her eyes, and she couldn't carry her own weight. They were happy to do the carrying. Straight to the bedroom. Halfway blind, nauseous, dizzy from the impact, Rebecca hadn't made much sense of the questions they threw at her.
When will your husband be home? Stop that noise. You don't want to wake the children, do you? Where's the lantern?
Rebecca had explained to them, as well as she could, that Isaac wasn't home. Wouldn't be home for weeks, most likely. They needed to go away. They needed to come back later. She didn't understand what was happening. She didn't understand why they were pulling her slippers off. Why they were pulling her stockings off. Of course she didn't want the children to wake. Why would she? It had taken nearly 2 hours to get them to sleep in the first place. The lantern. Did she own a lantern? She couldn't remember. Her head throbbed. Her vision spun. It is gut-wrenching to listen to her, the way her voice catches in her throat, to see her wipe snot on the sleeve of her blouse. I hate every one of these judges for making her do this. But she doesn't back down. She withholds nothing as she continues her story. Rebecca began to fight when they tossed her to the bed. Lying down made everything hurt worse. Only when they'd gotten her stripped to her shift did she begin to understand what was happening. And by that time, it was far, far too late. Rebecca's voice grows calmer the closer she gets to the end of her horrible tale.
It was Joshua Burgess who went first, she says.
Burgess had been reserved up to that point, keeping a few steps behind as North dragged her to the bedroom, quietly watching from the shadows as North stripped off her clothing. He was the one who'd forced her legs open, and North had pinned her there, spread eagle and trembling while Burgess slowly, methodically peeled away his own clothing. Boots, woolen socks. Then he ripped off the lace hem of her shift so that he could tie his hair back. What had happened to her shift after that, she didn't remember, but it was gone when he climbed on top of her. I have never seen a courtroom so quiet in my entire life. The testimony is horrifying. Rebecca spares no detail. She doesn't bother with modest speech or her own reputation. She has decided to shock and scandalize the neighbors who have insisted on being present to witness this public humiliation. She means to punish their curiosity. And I wonder if this isn't the first time that Isaac has fully heard her account, for he alternately seizes with rage and weeps openly beside her.
It hurt,
Rebecca's voice finally breaks. I want to reach for Rebecca, to scoop her up and hold her the way I hold my own daughters when they are sick or hurt. I want to shield her from this awful exposure. Rebecca's eyes find a safe spot on the wall behind Obadiah Wood, and she stares at it. Her voice slips into a monotone, devoid of all shock, all pain. She sounds like she is in another room, in another country, as she continues. While Burgess made relatively quick work of his assault, grunting into the pillow beside her head, then rolling off her body, North meant to punish her. He was not content with resignation. After the blinding pain in her head subsided, after she stopped thrashing on the bed, after she stopped begging for them to leave and grew quiet, he went to work, and he systematically dismantled her composure, left her trying to escape the confines of her own skin. Traitor, whore, Indian lover, Jezebel, temptress, wanton. He accused her of being all these things and more. Rebecca lifts a trembling hand and sets it over her left breast.
He flicked it, she says, over and over, until Burgess had to hold me down with his knees so I'd lie still. After a while, I couldn't feel anything else but that flicking. But it was the Indian lover, he kept repeating as he flicked. I couldn't scream.
She gasped, the tears coming.
What if I'd woken the boys? What if they had come in crying? What would I have said to them? What would those men have done to my babies?
North had taken her then, with Burgess holding her arms against the bed so she could not scratch or hit. It was well into the deepest hours of the night by the time he exhausted himself.
You'll not say a word of this to your husband or to anyone else. Do you understand?
North said, pulling on his trousers with the drowsy movements of a man satisfied with his work. She had deserved it, he said, for bringing those Indians into their town after the militia had worked so hard to beat them back into the wilderness. They'd had no choice but to teach her this lesson. North told her this even as he wiped the beads of sweat from his brow. They left her alone and naked and weeping in the soiled sheets. And she lay there, unable to move her limbs, listening to them tromp through the hallway toward the door, laughing, jesting about the way she'd begged them to stop. For one excruciating moment, they paused at the bottom of the stairs, and her heart pounded in her chest with a terror that they might go in search of her children. But they didn't. The three judges sit there and stare at her for several long moments, unsure what to make of her accusations. Finally, John Hubbard speaks.
And did you tell anyone? That day or the next?
Rebecca's eyes are deep pools of grief when she finally opens them.
Who could I tell? Judge North was the one who would hear my complaint.
And yet you have a witness.
Yes. Martha Ballard.
Hubbard calls me forward again.
It seems you are a busy woman, Mistress Ballard. How came you to be a witness in all of these matters?
They fall under the duties of my profession. I do not seek out such experiences, Your Honor.
Go on, then. Tell us what you know of Mistress Foster's claims.
Once again, I tell the court exactly how I found Rebecca, the same as I had in Vassalboro last month. I tell them of her injuries. I show them my diary and the entries I've made, along with the interactions I've had with Judge North since.
Thank you, Mistress Ballard, for your testimony, Parker says. We will hear from the defendant now, Mr. North.
He steps forward.
How do you plead in this cause? Not guilty. I have done nothing to this woman.
She has no proof, no witnesses to the act she claims happened. Nothing but a friend who saw her much later. I ask that you dismiss these charges. They should have never been brought in the first place.
It is worth noting, Judge Parker says, that there was a witness to the purported crime, but he is now dead. And that is a fact that this court finds both curious and rather convenient for you.
Am I being accused of murder now?
North asks, hissing the words through his teeth. I am simply stating an observation, Mr. North, and reminding you that we will pursue all avenues of investigation as it relates to both Mr. Burgess and this case, seeing as how they are intertwined.
Parker looks to Henry Sewell.
Please enter Mr. North's not guilty plea in the court records.
My wife can testify that I was home with her on the night these events allegedly took place,
North continues. Lydia has gone from looking gaunt in Vassalboro to positively ill now. Pale, lips thin and pressed together. Two fingers constantly massage her left temple.
He was home, she says.
I would ask you to consider my own reputation in this town,
North tells the judges,
versus that of Mistress Foster and her husband. These accusations are nothing more than a bit of petty revenge, a way of getting back at me for dismissing him as minister. He is suing the town for unpaid wages. Need you any more proof of their duplicity than that?
I watch Lydia sink back into her seat and wonder how often she is awake these days past 8 o'clock. How easy it would be for North to slip from bed with his wife unaware. And so it goes, back and forth, becoming less about what happened to Rebecca and more about her husband versus the man accused of raping her, as if Isaac had any bearing whatsoever upon what happened to Rebecca in August. As if his insistence on being paid the full amount agreed to in his contract has any relevance on the situation.
Have you anything else to add regarding the actual charges, Mr. North?
Wood finally interrupts.
No. Then please take your seat.
The court will now recess for a short time so that we might deliberate. He bangs the gavel. Then he, Parker, and Hubbard retreat to the storeroom to converse amongst themselves. I sit with Rebecca, hold her hand. We wait as the onlookers mill around the tavern and refill their mugs. Some go out to use the privy, sending a blast of cold air into the room every time they open the door. Others stretch their legs. After some time, 10 or 15 minutes perhaps, the judges return to the tavern and lift their faces to Rebecca Foster. John Hubbard bangs his gavel.
The Court of Common Pleas has decided that charges will be brought against Joseph North,
he announces. James Parker adds,
however, it remains the duty of the court to point out that there are no witnesses who actually saw Mrs. Foster being accosted. And without such a witness, it would not be lawful to try this man in a capital case that could result in his death. It is therefore the decision of the court to declare charges of attempted rape.
The tavern erupts. People leap to their feet. Some clap their relief. Others shout their outrage. But I cannot bear to look at Rebecca, cannot bear to witness her heartbreak a second time. So I look to Ephraim instead and see everything I feel reflected in his eyes. Regardless of what might happen in the coming trial, Joseph North will not hang for what he did to Rebecca. Obadiah Wood bangs his gavel to settle the outburst caused by this news.
We are not finished. It is our decision that this case go to trial before the Supreme Judicial Court 3 months hence. The defendant shall be remanded to the jail yard at Fort Western until that time. Colonel North, please step forward and acknowledge that you understand the charges.
the parameters of your constraints at Fort Western, and that you will be present for trial.
Wood looks around the room.
Colonel?
Lydia North remains in her seat, but her husband is not with her. He is not in the tavern at all. I sit in my workroom, journal spread open on the desk, and write as the storm barrels in from the east, across the Atlantic, a monster building out in the ocean and pushing all that wind and snow across the coast and inland, building, building until it is a wall of white that swallows everything in its path. We are home now, and the household bustles around me. Hannah and Dolly make dinner while the men, Barnabas included, stomp in and out with armloads of wood to prepare for what is coming. They close the shutters and build the fires, piling in warming stones that can be wrapped and taken to bed later. Ephraim insisted that Barnabas stay the night with us instead of riding the 4 hours back to Vassalboro. Apparently, I am not the only one who has grown fond of the boy. Beside the hearth is a chessboard. And, between chores, Cyrus and Barnabas take their turns. They've been at it for hours, quietly battling each other. I've never seen Cyrus lose the game, but something tells me that I should not discount Barnabas Lambert. Hannah and Dolly ignore them, of course. They've seen pissing contests before. I finish the entry by stabbing my quill into the paper. Colonel North fled from judgment and could not be found. Ballard's Mill, Saturday, January 30. I am wakened by a hand on my shoulder, shaking. Gently. A whisper. Warm breath on my ear. I hadn't slept well, too aware of the wind seeping through the chinks in the walls, of the plummeting cold, and the snow that was falling, not like a blanket, but like a burial shroud.
Come look, Ephraim says, and I feel him reach for my hand.
He pulls me to my feet, steps close as I wobble, his hands roving over my thin shift, through my hair, down my back, across my bottom. A laugh, and then he leans over and pulls a blanket off the bed, wraps it around my shoulders as I stand unsteadily beside the bed, still wondering why he's woken me. Ephraim leads me through the dim house, our fingers intertwined. He's lit the candles and built the fire, but it can't yet be 5 in the morning, and the household is still asleep, everyone in their beds, except for Barnabas, who snores on a pallet by the fire. Or perhaps he only pretends to sleep. As I blink away the cobwebs in my eyes, I see his head shift toward us as we walk by, but his eyes remain closed. A light sleeper, then, I think. A cautious man. The chessboard lies beside him on the floor, unchanged from last night. When we reach the door, Ephraim nudges me to the side, then pulls it open. Before me stands a wall of white nearly to the lintel. Only 6 inches of pale pewter clouds can be seen above the snowdrift. I've seen drifts pile up to 3, maybe 4 feet, but only once before have I seen anything like this.
It's still coming down, he says. Not as heavy as earlier, but it doesn't show any signs of stopping.
I reach out a hand, palm flat, and press it into the snowbank. It is soft but frigid, and my hand sinks in, leaving a print. I am awake now, aware of what my husband has been trying to say these last minutes. It's like it was in Oxford, I tell him. He nods, smiles.
So you remember then?
Like that is a thing I will ever forget. Ephraim Ballard takes my hand and leads me back to bed. 35 years ago. Oxford, Massachusetts. January 19, 1755.
What did you say?
My cheek rested against Ephraim's bare chest. But still, even that close, I barely heard what he'd whispered. My hand lay on his heart, and he ran his fingers through my hair slowly, letting it slide through and fall back to pool around my bare shoulders. The sun wasn't up, but even if it had been, we wouldn't have known, for the storm still raged outside, and the sky was as black as it had been for 2 days. The cabin was warm, however, as were we. The fire burned low and red in the hearth, casting a dreamy glow across the bed. Occasionally, a draft of frigid air slipped beneath the door, and he pulled me closer, letting his skin warm mine. Nothing lay between us now. I'd taken off my shift with trembling hands the night before, and it remained on the floor where it had fallen, when it slid over my shoulders and pooled at my feet. "Hmm?" he asked, realizing only now that I'd asked a question. I propped myself up on my elbow and looked into his cloudless eyes. "You said something. What was it?"
"Ah."
I couldn't be sure, but I thought he blushed.
"More Solomon."
"Oh." Ephraim had been whispering the Song of Solomon into my ear all night, calming me with ancient words that astonished me with the depth of their romantic understanding.
"You are altogether beautiful, my darling," he repeated and pulled me back against him.
As promised, Ephraim had not tried to seduce me in the first days and weeks of our marriage. He had waited patiently, kissed me whenever he pleased, and held me through every long cold night. He waited first until I bled, and then longer until we were both half mad with desire. I had wondered at first if his determination was so that he would know whether any child conceived was his or not. Surely that mattered to a man. But soon it became apparent that it was an assurance he wanted me to have. To know one way or another. To remove a question that might linger for a lifetime. And we knew, plain enough, a week after we were married. And that, of course, made our situation less complicated for a few days. Gave us a chance to learn how to live in the same space without constantly dancing around the tension of not yet having consummated our marriage. But soon my cycle ended, and January came, and brought with it the kind of cold and weather I associate only with this month. It brought winter, and forced us inside except for all but the briefest tasks. It forced us into prolonged closer proximity. As promised, he let the decision be mine. And because I did not know how to surrender, I waited too long. Even then he did not complain. But last night, preparing for bed, I knew. We had been married a month, and in that time Ephraim Ballard had proved what kind of man he was. I had nothing left to fear. It was time for me to decide what kind of wife I would be. So I did. But first I procrastinated, brushing my hair as I sat on the small stool before the fire. I let him strip naked, as he always did, and climb into bed. I let him sit there and watch me for several long moments, let his eyes run over everything that he could see. Then I set down my brush and went to stand before him. The look on my face must have been clear because he froze, didn't draw a breath. Our eyes remained locked as I tugged my shift off one shoulder.
"Are you sure?"
he asked, voice husky. I answered by baring my other shoulder so that the thin fabric could fall away. He said nothing as he gazed, said nothing for long, uncountable seconds. But when Ephraim Ballard finally found his voice, I understood why he chose Song of Solomon as the text for my reading lessons. The words themselves were a primer, a perfect, exquisite example of how a man ought to take his wife to bed for the very first time. And as Solomon had, Ephraim began at the top and worked his way down, illuminating the meaning of each line I'd so carefully transcribed into my book over the last month. Words that had seemed practical and agrarian, but when experienced as action, were nothing short of erotic.
"How beautiful you are, my darling. Your eyes, your hair,
your lips,
your mouth, your neck, your breasts. I will go my way to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of frankincense. You are altogether beautiful, my darling. You have made my heart beat faster with a single glance of your eyes. Your lips, my bride, drip honey. May my beloved come into his garden and eat its choice fruits. These were the words whispered in my ear as I surrendered to every gaze and touch last night while the storm fell upon us, roaring its approval. Never have I been so warm. Never have I felt so safe. And then, hours later, he pulled me tighter, as though terrified I would slip from our bed and break the spell. He whispered the words again, intent on kindling this newly wakened desire, determined to stoke it into a blaze that consumed us both. 4. Midwifery, February 1790. A Sad Tale's Best for Winter. William Shakespeare, The Winter's Tale. The Parsonage, Saturday, February 13. Monday, February 1, a snowstorm. Thursday, February 4, it snowed. Saturday, February 6, a very cold day. Sunday, February 7, clear and excessive cold. Monday, February 8, terrible, cold and windy. God, I hate winter, I say, closing the journal and massaging my temples with the tips of my fingers. It is both a prayer and a curse, and I don't feel guilty for either. For nearly 2 weeks, there has been little but cold and snow and a long, brooding oppression. So when the letter arrived this morning, summoning me to the Fosters, I was not annoyed. The fact that it came from a lawyer also piqued my interest. Dear Mistress Ballard, if it presents no challenge, would you be kind enough to meet me at the parsonage for tea this afternoon? 1 sharp. Respectfully, Seth Parker, Esquire. Tell your father that Mr. Parker has summoned me to the Fosters, I say, passing through the kitchen. Hannah looks to the window where the snow is still piled high, then back to me as though I said I was going to jump off the barn roof. It's horrid out there. Staying here won't make it any less so. Rebecca Foster is 6 months pregnant and finally showing. With her first child, it took longer, but with each subsequent child, her body has revealed the secret earlier. I marvel at how this varies woman to woman. Some blossom in the early months and others wait until the final weeks. Rebecca does not often leave her house now, and without Sally Pierce to help, the parsonage feels dusty and cluttered. It feels, perhaps not unjustifiably, as if its mistress has given up. Rebecca has made tea for those assembled, however, and there is fresh bread with butter and jam to go with it. The two young Foster boys, blonde like their mother, wander into the sitting room for a piece, then skip out with sticky fingers. I watch them go, wondering if they can sense the heaviness in the room, or if they are oblivious to adult concerns. Thank you for coming, Mistress Ballard, Seth Parker tells me. I hope it wasn't too difficult getting here. I managed well enough. Esquire Parker is one of a handful of lawyers in Hollowell, but like most men in the area, he dabbles in both river trade and farming. There isn't much need for lawyering in this part of the world, so he isn't often called upon in that capacity. But now that the hearings are complete and charges, albeit minimal, have been filed, the Fosters need someone to represent them at trial. I have already taken Rebecca's deposition, he says, pointing to a small stack of papers on the little table in front of him. Beside it rests another blank stack, along with ink pot and quill. If you will tell me everything you remember,
I will write it down. You have only to make your mark at the end.
I can write it myself, I say, voice clipped with irritation, and sign my name as well.
Ah, that's right. You keep a daybook.
Yes, for many years now, I am quite comfortable with the pen.
Very well, then.
He slides paper and quill across the table so they rest in front of me. This will be submitted as evidence to the court in Palnoboro. As I situate myself in front of the paper, Isaac Foster makes his way into the room.
Mistress Ballard,
he greets me, then kisses the top of his wife's head. He stands before the fire, warming his rump. It is winter, after all, and none of us are ever truly warm unless butted up to an open flame. Isaac pours a cup of tea as I begin my deposition.
Henry Sewell visited us yesterday, he tells Seth. Is that so? He brought a letter.
I look up sharply, pen hovering over the paper.
Why? A preacher by the name of Cobb has been offered my position. I am told he will start sometime in May, and he requires a permanent home as part of his salary. We have until the end of April to find new accommodations.
But Rebecca is due to deliver at the end of April, I argue. There is a note in Isaac's voice that I cannot identify.
A fact not taken into consideration.
Where will you go? Seth Parker leans forward, his elbows resting on his knees.
Nowhere yet. I am filing an appeal citing conflict of interest given that Joseph North is the head of the church committee.
And failing that? I ask. Rebecca pushes against her stomach, wincing. To Fort Western, most likely. To rented rooms.
There has to be another option, I say. I can assure you that I am exploring every option on their behalf, Mistress Ballard. But if you truly want to help, the best thing you can do is finish your deposition.
Conversation predictably drifts to the weather as my gentle scratchings continue. The storms, the snow, the ice that rises higher along the banks of the Kennebec, the terrible state of every road leading in and out of the Hook. Why are men so obsessed with roads, I will never understand. It is inane background noise to each deliberate word that I etch onto the paper. Several minutes later, I set the quill down and flex my hand. And how is your wife, Mr. Parker? Is she well?
Ellen, aye. Right as rain, I'd say. Why do you ask?
No reason. Do pass along my greetings. Whatever ailment caused Ellen to seek out doctor has either resolved itself or remained hidden from her husband's knowledge. I hand the paper to Mr. Parker and watch as he considers my neat, concise handwriting. After a moment, he gives me an approving nod.
Thank you again for coming, Mr. Ballard.
Of course. But since I'm here, I'd like to examine Rebecca. Make sure all is well with her and the child.
Child.
That's the point when Rebecca flinches, her mouth tightening at the corners. She turns away from her husband and heaves out of the chair, passing him on the way to their bedroom without a word. Rebecca lies on her bed in a cotton shift as I move my fingers over her swollen belly, prodding here and there. I am sorry about the letter, I tell her. As am I. But the trial will do no good. Rebecca looks at me, those brown eyes certain. You saw what happened at the last hearing. Even if they find him guilty, it will be for attempting a crime, not committing one. There is nothing left for us in the Hook. Isaac is the one fighting to stay. I'd rather start over somewhere new, where no one knows what happened to me. I open my mouth to argue, but she interrupts. You know I'm right. You just like me too much to admit it. Oh, the burning that tears induce, sometimes worse than fire. You are right, I whisper. I hate that you are right. One of the greatest skills that I have as a midwife is to sit in silence. I cannot count the number of times that I have wordlessly held a hand as grief explodes in a room. The only antidote to this kind of despair is to create a bulwark of immovable calm, to sit and be, to pray and offer comfort, to watch the shadows cut tracks along the wall as the sun slowly moves across the sky, to say nothing when there are no words that can console. And it is in this laden silence that I feel the child in Rebecca's womb move, a thumping, strong and steady. I remain where I am, fingers spread wide across her belly, concentrating on the rhythmic taps that rise from her body, that shifting, squirming proof of life. I wait a full 6 heartbeats before whispering, "How long since it quickened?"
"Not long, a month or so."
"You didn't tell me."
"I hoped it would stop."
Rebecca turns away, looks at the wall.
"I still do."
A few moments later, I stand outside the parsonage, breathing cold air through my nose to calm my mind and still the rage. It isn't fair. This is what runs through my mind over and over like a dog chasing its tail. It isn't fair. Vengeance might be the Lord's, but hasn't he appointed men to be the arbiters of justice? Where is it for a woman like Rebecca? And who can bring a judge to justice? As I trot up the narrow channel of packed snow on Water Street astride Brutus, a thought occurs to me, so quickly that I do not have time to reject it. If Joseph North cannot be hanged for raping Rebecca Foster, perhaps he can be hanged for killing Joshua Burgess. Saturday, February 13. Clear and cold. The ice builds at Fort Western. I was summoned to appear this day at the house of Isaac Foster to give evidence to what I know concerning the cause there to be tried. Came home in the early evening. Mrs. Densmore here to cut me a gown of green silk. She tells me that the wife of James Bridge was delivered at the first hour this morning of a dead-born son who is to be interred this evening. Dr. Page was the operator. I am not angry that Clarissa Stone didn't call for me. There are other midwives, and she could have sent for any of them. But Peggy? After what Page did to Clarissa's child, there was no excuse for her pride. She had all the information she needed. I can count on one hand the number of men I have ever truly hated in my entire life. But Benjamin Page is near the top of that list. Billy Crane takes first place, followed closely by Joseph North. But since Page's arrival in Hollowell, he has been nothing but a pestilence. God, I'd strangle him with my bare hands if I could. Ballard's Mill. Monday, February 15.
"Why is he here?" Ephraim asks.
I've come down to the mill with lunch for Ephraim. He's been working on the water wheel since dawn, and somehow looks both sweaty and freezing. The wheel is still locked in the frozen creek, and my husband has determined that now is the best time to make much-needed repairs to several of the wooden paddles that have rotted or cracked.
"Barnabas?"
I ask, looking over my shoulder. I rather thought his reasons would be obvious. I hand Ephraim his plate, but he sets it down on a stump.
"He hasn't come courting," Ephraim says. "Look at him."
Barnabas is haggard. He's ridden hard and long with the wind at his face. His cheeks are red, his lips chapped. Perhaps he was in a hurry to see Dolly. Even as I say the words, I know that my husband is right, as always. Ephraim pulls his mouth into a hard line.
"That boy doesn't want to be here. He's scared."
Barnabas has brought the wagon. Lately, he's been coming on horseback. But those were social calls. I've only ever seen him on that wagon, the one with the iron loop affixed to the sideboard, twice. Ephraim takes a menacing step forward as Barnabas jumps down from his seat. He looks like he's swallowed a gallon of vinegar. He takes off his hat, whacks his thigh, looks to the clouds, squints, shakes his head as though arguing with the Almighty.
"Why are you here?" Ephraim demands.
It is the first time I have ever seen Barnabas Lambert out of sorts. He nearly chokes on the words.
I'm here to arrest your son for the murder of Joshua Burgess.
Ephraim's voice is low and deep. Dangerous.
Which son?
The word must be painful for Barnabas, like cut glass on his tongue, and he struggles to spit it out. After a moment, he looks to me as though pleading for help. It's a mercy he won't get, not today.
Cyrus.
The only thing our oldest child has ever wanted in all his life is to go to sea. Though I know he'd deny it, I suspect Cyrus wants to be a pirate, to climb rigging and perch in a crow's nest and see exotic locations. He wants, more than anything, a life of adventure, a life filled with salt air and blue water, and a fist shaken in defiance at the stormy horizon. He's been robbed of this future, however, and makes do with sailing the Kennebec and navigating his father's logs to ports downriver. In winter, however, he is landlocked, and his only solace is Mill Pond, where he goes to fish almost every day. So we trudge up the path, the four of us, in search of him. Ephraim, Barnabas, who looks as though he'd rather eat a pile of steaming entrails. Me, and Dolly. She'd seen him arrive. Of course she had. That girl looks for him like a first-century believer waiting for the return of Christ. So no sooner had we passed the garden gate than she came rushing out the front door, drying her hands on a kitchen towel. But the girl is perceptive, more so than any 17-year-old I've ever met, and she knows something is wrong. No one will answer her questions, however, and now she's angry as well. "Where are we going?" she demands. "Why is he here? Why won't anyone answer me?" I give her a warning look that makes her swallow the next question, and I can see her anger turn to fear in the span of a single blink. She finally understands.
"He wouldn't dare," Dolly whispers.
She grabs my forearm and squeezes hard.
"He wouldn't."
It takes decades to really know a man, Dolly, and you've barely had weeks with that one. I'd suggest you not assume anything about what he will or will not do. It's a hard lesson, but it's best she learn it now. Dolly falls silent, then falls into step behind me on the narrow path. Ephraim leads the pack. Twice Barnabas looks back at me and, judging by the look on his face, believes he's being led into the woods as a ritual sacrifice. I can't say the thought hasn't crossed my husband's mind, but mostly I suspect he wants to see if Barnabas has the courage to follow through with his mission. Mill Pond is a half mile north of the house and sits in the middle of a sprawling meadow. The pond isn't all that big, only 2 acres across, but is quite deep in the middle and is the happy home to many hundreds of blueback trout. Cyrus discovered it within a day of our moving to this property 11 years ago and promptly claimed it as his own. He stands in the center of the pond now, atop 2 feet of ice, holding a fishing line in each hand. He's kept the hole open all winter, and its sides are jagged from constant chipping with the hatchet. Cyrus sees his father first and offers a broad smile, but Barnabas steps into the clearing next, then me, followed by Dolly, and the smile melts off his lips. When his eyes sharpen, and his fists tighten over the fishing poles, I know he's understood the reason for this interruption. Cyrus twists his lips in displeasure, mouths some profanity that will never reach the air, nods. Then he pulls both poles from the water and trudges back across the ice. We watch as he collects his fishing paraphernalia, bucket, poles, string, hooks, and strides toward us. He drops everything at Ephraim's feet, and then his hands move in a flurry, thumb pointing at himself, flat hand slicing through the air as though to say, didn't, and then fist to the side of his neck in imitation of holding a noose.
I know, Ephraim says, but Barnabas here believes that you did. No, I do not. But arresting you is the job I've been given. Dr. Page's testimony was damning.
He looks to the side and glares at me, as though I should have shared what I knew about the beating long ago.
And the court has ordered that I bring you in.
Cyrus studies him quietly, then turns to Ephraim and flaps his hand, indicating he's free to interrogate the boy.
And where will you take him? Ephraim asks. Vassalboro. He'll have to appear before Judge Wood. But once he posts bail, he'll be remanded to the jail yard at Fort Western. And what proof do they have?
Ephraim asks.
Proof? None so far as I know. Only the testimony of Dr. Page, which was confirmed by at least 5 other people. So the court will look into the matter.
His voice is calmer now that he's had the chance to explain everything. But Barnabas still seems unsettled. He likes Cyrus. I know this for a fact. And he's not looked Dolly in the eye once. She, however, hasn't stopped glaring at him since we arrived at the pond.
You cannot do this!
It's almost a shout, but not quite. Dolly isn't the type to descend into hysterics, but she does have a temper, and she's letting Barnabas see it for the first time. He winces, then takes a deep breath. Barnabas takes a step toward Cyrus.
I don't want to do this. Please believe that. But if you fight me, I'll have to fight you back.
I think of how handily he subdued James Wall. Barnabas, however, has never seen Cyrus throw a punch.
When will he stand before Obadiah Wood?
Ephraim asks.
Tomorrow. And the hearing?
At the end of next month, Friday, March 26th. Dolly's head swivels back and forth as she takes in this conversation between her father and her suitor. And with every second that passes, her brows draw closer together and her cheeks burn hotter.
No, she says, I will not have it. You will not arrest my brother. You said yourself he's done nothing wrong.
I said that I don't believe that he has.
Barnabas's voice is nothing but a whisper, and his eyes remain focused on Cyrus. He's waiting, watching to see if Cyrus will bolt. He is no longer the charming young man who has dined with us several times, but rather the efficient, ruthless officer of the court.
Dolly, Ephraim warns.
Stop!
She turns on her father, and he blinks in surprise. This may be the first time she has ever directly defied him.
You cannot let this happen!
This, he warns, has nothing to do with you.
It has everything to do with me!
She hisses. Dolly leaves my side and trudges through the snow to stand in front of Barnabas. She isn't quite as tall as I am, but she raises herself to her full height nonetheless.
Do not do this, she tells him.
I have to.
Still, his gaze is pinned on Cyrus.
Please.
You don't understand.
I understand perfectly.
I'd wondered, perhaps, if her feelings for Barnabas were rooted in infatuation. He is the first man who's ever paid her serious attention, after all. And that tends to addle a girl's mind. But no, I hear it there in her trembling voice. She cares for him, but she loves her brother.
If you arrest him, I will never speak to you again. Not one time, ever.
It's the wrong thing to say, and she knows it the moment the words have slipped into the cold, brittle air. But she is stubborn, like me, and won't back down now that she's taken a stand. His eyes shudder and his spine stiffens. My husband was right. This has nothing to do with Dolly, and the fact that she's inserted herself into a matter of the court has disappointed Barnabas Lambert. His voice is as cold as river ice when he answers,
I am sorry to hear that.
Barnabas doesn't see the slap coming. I'd guess he hears it before he feels it. But by then, she's turned away and is marching down the path toward the house. He is dumbfounded. But Cyrus is grinning. And Ephraim can't decide whether to laugh or charge after his daughter. So I'm the one to speak. Cyrus didn't kill anyone, I say.
I know that.
Barnabas's voice is strangled, and he spares one longing glance at Dolly's retreating form.
I do, and it will bear out in court soon enough. You'll see. There's nothing, not a single witness, who saw him near Burgess after the frolic.
Then why is the court doing this?
To prove that they followed through on the matter, that they were thorough, in case questions are asked.
Are questions being asked?
Yes, but not about Cyrus. The concern is to do with North. He got away, and they don't want their authority being called into question. More has happened in this county during the last 4 months than in the last 4 years. Every single judge on that court is under a lot of scrutiny.
From whom?
The Supreme Judicial Court.
So my son has fallen prey to politics.
I wish I could say it isn't true.
Ephraim narrows his eyes.
And you're willing to be part of this. I'm the sort of man who does my job, Mr. Ballard,
Barnabas says, directing his gaze briefly to my husband.
If nothing else, I hope you can respect that.
After that one quick glance, he turns his focus back to Cyrus. It's like he's preparing for the fight, wagering if it will be man to man or two against one. I can see he's not pleased about either option, but he is ready for them.
Are you going to fight me?
He asks Cyrus. It would be one hell of a fight. And were they other men, any other men, actually, I might pay to see it. The woods are quiet. So quiet I can hear the breath of everyone present. There is no wind, no birdsong, no chatter of squirrels or the sliding of snow from pine boughs. My oldest child takes a step forward. He balls his fists. He grins, mischievous, and damn it all if I don't realize he's enjoying this. Then Cyrus holds his hands out, wrists pressed together, and waits for Barnabas Lambert to bind them with a rope. White Saddlery, Friday, February 19. The saddle shop is all but hidden from the road. It sits a block off Winthrop Street in the middle of the hook, accessible only by a path through the snowdrifts. It is attached to a small timber home with wooden shingles, and I can hear the tap, tap, tap of a leather punch, then the clean whoosh of a strap cutter as I lead Brutus through the narrow channel of dirty snow. The entire place smells of leather, not like a tanner's shop, all rank and fetid with tallow and carcass, but rich and burnished, like belts and bags and boots. Jeremiah White crafts other things as well, reins and gloves mostly, but he makes his real living on saddles. I still use the one I bought from him a decade ago, and I slide out of it as I dismount Brutus before the hitching post. After unbuckling my satchel, I go left to the front door since my business is not with Jeremiah today, but the door swings open before I can knock. I haven't seen Rachel Blossom since I found her, Clarissa Stone, and Peggy Bridge gossiping that day at Coleman's store. She pulls up short when she finds me on the step. Then, glancing behind her, she closes the door. I want to apologize to you as well, she says, lifting her small pointed chin in defiance, as though I think her incapable of such a thing.
As well, I ask.
I've just apologized to Sarah for what we did that day. You were right, it was disgraceful, and I'm sorry.
She offers no defense for her actions, doesn't chase the admission with a but, and I respect her all the more for it.
Clarissa and Peggy are your friends, it can be hard to speak up.
It shouldn't be.
She looks away, blinks back tears. When Rachel meets my gaze again, she sets a hand to her stomach and pulls her dress tight to reveal the small mound. I would have never noticed otherwise. She's maybe 5 months along. Will you still deliver this one? I won't call for Dr. Page. They shouldn't have either. I pull Rachel close and wrap my arms around her. Of course, it would be my honor. And I am sorry for Clarissa and Peggy. If they'd called for me, I would have come. I know. Rachel pulls away and clears her throat. I like Sarah. I hope she'll let me visit again.
I like her too.
And I think she'd be a good friend to you. Rachel bids me goodbye, and I watch her disappear around the corner of Winthrop Street. I turn back to the door and knock, but don't have to wait long before it is thrown back by a small woman with graying hair pulled into a tight bun.
Martha!
Mistress White, I nod in greeting.
Do come in.
She wipes her hands on her apron and ushers me inside.
It has been too long since I've seen you. To what do I owe the pleasure of this visit?
I've actually come for Sarah, if you don't mind. Alice White is startled to hear this, but doesn't say so.
Of course. Busy day for her. She's in her room with the baby now. I'll get her. Please, have a seat.
I take one of the two polished wooden chairs before the window and tuck my satchel underneath. There is whispering in the other room, urgent, possibly frustrated, but I can't make out the words. After a moment, Alice slips back out.
She'll just be a moment, she says. Don't mind me.
There is nowhere for the older woman to retreat, so she picks up her knitting, goes to the kitchen table, and makes a show of spreading out her yarn and needles. Sarah White lives with her parents, still sleeps in the same bedroom she occupied as a child. Only now there is a cradle against the wall, and a general aura of sadness permeating the house. After a few minutes, she comes out, baby tucked into the crook of her left arm, as she tries to button her blouse with her other hand. She joins me at the window while Mrs. White knits a pair of socks and pretends not to listen.
It is good to see you, Sarah says.
And you? I lift the plump little girl from Sarah's arms and fold back the blanket from her face. You both look well.
Forgive me for taking so long. I was nursing.
I thought you might be.
She eats so much, all the time, but it doesn't seem to matter. I am still making more milk than one baby can consume. It's...
She waves a hand in the air.
Relentless.
Consider yourself blessed. I've known more than one woman to go dry long before a baby is 9 months. Nurse her for as long as you can. It will do the both of you a world of good. Typically, I give this advice for the baby's health and also to help a young woman regain her figure. However, it does not appear that Sarah is struggling in that regard. Her dress reveals the same hourglass figure she sported before, if not a bit heavier on top. Sarah looks at me, large eyes curious.
I heard about Cyrus. It's outrageous what happened. Is he all right?
Though I hate that news of his arrest has spread, I am encouraged by her interest. He's as well as can be expected. The jail yard is difficult in winter. So few hours between sunup and sundown, hard to put in a full day's work. But I'm certain the charges will be dismissed. Cyrus had nothing to do with Burgess's murder. She lowers her voice to a near whisper so her mother cannot hear.
You are certain it was murder?
I am.
Good, she says,
then smiles fondly at her daughter.
Good riddance to him. Sarah,
I shift the baby in my arms and lean closer. Did you ever have trouble with Joshua Burgess?
No more than anyone else. He could never keep his eyes to himself. But there was one time that he...
She blushes and turns to the window, but looks more angry than embarrassed.
He what? Offered to pay me, so I'd go to bed with him.
My stomach twists into a knot.
Oh, God. The fee you paid me last month. No, I refused him, of course. But he was steaming mad. Said I was a whore now and couldn't afford to be picky.
Having a child out of wedlock doesn't make you a whore.
I know that, and told him as much.
Did he threaten you?
No. But if I was in town, he had a habit of being there. Always watching. It scared me. So I wasn't sad when I heard that he'd been killed.
Less sad when I heard that you'd called it murder. You aren't alone in that.
I think about it, though. What he said. That I can't afford to be picky. He was wrong. I have to be picky.
She nods toward the baby.